Hello, and welcome to episode 70 of Expertise is Overrated, the podcast that takes the time to answer the questions you didn't know, you didn't want the answers to. I'm Vib.
And I'm Sean, and neither of us has any clue what we're talking about.
Unlike New York Times best-selling author Dan Abnett, please fix this.
You're a moron. In so many ways.
Of course, I was going to always read that out because it was funny because you wrote that line, which is fucking shit. So I wrote, that is fucking shit. And so you just added, please fix this. And I was like, I'm just going to read that out.
I didn't see you write, this is shit.
Oh, did you not?
I genuinely didn't. No.
I think that's awful.
No, I didn't see that. So I just assumed that you would fix it by ad-libbing. Like, this whole recording has been a shambles from the start from you. You were chuckling through your intro. You had the longest pregnant pause of all time before you actually started talking. And we had three abortive false starts because you kept leaving long silences and then starting to talk about something else.
You're quite done.
Yeah, no, that's it. I got it out of my system. Thank you.
I mean, the reason I left such a long pause is because I had to edit your bloody audio yesterday.
Oh. Did I not leave a long enough pause?
No, I don't blame you necessarily. We both take extraordinary amounts of really breathy breaths at the end of certain sentences. It's quite remarkable.
We really do. I think it's just a symptom of us both being wildly out of shape.
That's exactly what I thought as well.
I can feel myself doing it now. I get to the end of a sentence and I'm like, I'm running out of breath.
Coming up from the bottom of the ocean. It's partly that. I think it's also just quite a natural thing, and the mic seems to just pick that up really quite clearly.
Yeah, I think that's also true.
I mean, people did say this about Blue Yetis, right? I mean, I love it, but equally it's quite sensitive.
I think it's sensitive without being discriminatory, which like is a good thing in general, but in a microphone you want a little bit of discrimination. Like, just don't pick up that sound.
Yeah.
Probably we could get a noise gate or something.
Probably.
That sounds like a thing that people have, but I think that, you know, there's so many of these steps that we could take that would really ruin the essence of what we are, which is a little bit shit.
A little bit shit, and also talking about absolute nonsense for the first couple of minutes before we always actually get into it. Which is, always, ironically, the thing I brought up at the start of our recording.
Yeah.
That Sean yelled at me for just now. So, yeah, take that. Huh.
That's a closed door downstairs, never mind. We've had an exciting day, though. I think
we have had an exciting... Well, I mean, it seems to have actually made very little difference, but ostensibly an exciting day.
Well, there's nothing on there, and we haven't posted about it to anyone, so it's perhaps not surprising, but do you want the fanfare, shall I say it?
I mean, if anybody actually listened to the episode that came out on the 5th of February, they'd know.
Yeah, it's true. I feel hurt now.
Just say. We mentioned it right at the start of that episode, so you know, people didn't even have to make upsetting. It very far.
Oh. This was always the risk, really, wasn't it?
It sort of was. I mean, you know, it's fun to do. We'll see how it progresses. But yeah, you can spill the beans.
Can't get worse. We launched our Patreon today, in theory. Well, not in theory. I mean, it's live. I can see it. I can see that no one's following us for no content, which, to be honest,
is fair.
Seems fair.
It's fair. A shout out to two members of our Discord who very kindly kind of looked over it yesterday.
Yeah, that was very kind of them. Thank you.
Although we were then shocked to learn that, you know, people go on Patreon for podcasts that have got 700 plus regular episodes and 300 and something plus bonus episodes. And it makes me feel inadequate.
Yeah, that was astounding.
Yeah. Not going to lie, it makes me feel a bit inadequate. But, you know, episode 70 is not bad going for two people who don't really like each other fundamentally.
This is always what we should come back to. When we set this up way back in episode 1, it was just an outlet because we were yelling at each other over Discord.
We could have just gone our separate ways, but no.
Yeah, instead we decided to subject victims, innocent people, who accidentally downloaded our episode thinking they might get nuanced debate on the Brexit referendum, instead get this. So, you know.
Nuanced debate on the Brexit referendum.
Have you not heard this? So when I talk to people about this podcast, like a lot of people think that it's a politics podcast, and they think we're riffing on Michael Gove's People Have Had Enough of Experts.
Well, okay, wow. Why don't we do that? Why don't we do that? That's way better. We could do that.
I don't think we can compete with The Rest Is Politics, sadly.
I'm sure we can. Are they having nuanced debates about Brexit?
There's not a lot of nuance going on, to be fair.
I was
going to
say, like, if they are, then they're doing it wrong.
they're fairly aligned on Brexit.
Yeah. Okay, so as of episode 71, politics. They're not in Westeros, in real places.
Real world politics.
Like, you know, Bermuda.
Very rogue.
Yeah, I don't know why that came into my head first.
You thought you tried to be funny again, didn't you? We've talked about this.
Well, I was going to go US, and I was like, that's too obvious. I'll go a little bit closer to home, and then for some reason ended up in Bermuda. But there you go.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's kind of... All right. Anyway, what are we talking Patreon, very about exciting. Today? Please go do check it out. My word. I swear I've not even had anything to drink today.
Go and have a sit down.
I am sat down.
Oh, and then in which case there's no hope for you.
Oh, you're stood up, aren't you?
Yep.
I really hope your camera's not recording properly. That would actually fill me with immense joy.
Everything looks okay.
I say that. It's not like we've actually edited any of the video content yet, but hey,
we don't really know what
one thing at a time.
That, anyway.
Shall we move to the matter at hand?
Yes.
What is the matter
at hand?
8 minutes
in. The matter at hand. So I finished a book last night.
Did you actually manage to finish it? Because you were struggling by the end, it sounded like.
It's got the world's longest, like, afterword, epilogue, thanks from the author, all of that. So actually, it's only about three quarters of the book is book. So
I see.
When I thought I was only halfway through it, I was a lot further through it than I thought I was.
This is, of course, the final book of the Horus Heresy?
I really hope so. This is The End and the Death, Volume 3, which is the 8th book in the Siege of Terror series, which is itself the concluding arc of the Horus Heresy series, all published by Black Library, Games Workshop's in-house publisher, detailing the events of the Horus Heresy, which are sort of set the stage for Warhammer 40k.
Yeah.
There's so much of it. There is so much of it.
There really is a lot of it. I'm just looking up to see exactly how much there is, and even just the wiki is unbelievably long.
Well, I looked this up before we started recording. Horus Rising, the first book in the Horus Heresy, was published in 2006.
And it's actually not as long ago as I thought it would be.
Really? 2006 was a long time ago. We were both still in high school.
Yeah, but I was into the hobby before then, and I swear people were already talking about the Horus Heresy. Well, obviously it's in the codices and stuff, but, you know.
Yeah, we can come back to that. There are 54 novels in the Horus Heresy series.
That's ridiculous.
24 novellas, 47 audio dramas, and then the 8 books of the Siege of Terror on top of that. Is that too much? That feels like too much.
It is too much. So what, that's 18 odd years, 54 books. I mean, you do the maths.
Can you do the maths, please?
No, the reason I'm asking you is because... But I mean, it's 3 odd books a year, right? Which is quite a lot, really.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Obviously, it's not all the same author. That would be ridiculous for anybody who isn't Brandon Sanderson.
No, it's not all the same author. That is worth making clear. But... I think, I'm so sort of slightly done in by finishing The End and the Death Volume 3.
So that is the last book as it stands, right?
Well, Jimmy Space is in the Golden Throne and Horus is dead. So
yeah,
I don't really know where else they could possibly... There's small stories that they could tell about how you get from that sort of end... state all the way through to
but this is fundamentally the issue of the whole series though, isn't it? Like we always knew it was going to end up here. It was a really famous moment and somehow they dragged it out, but for 54 novels.
It's got two problems, I think. You're right. Everyone knew where we were going to get to, but almost as a result of that, literally nothing that happens in it matters.
Yeah, exactly. It's the fundamental issue with it.
So you spend the first few books with Horus and the sons of Horus, and one of the characters is Ezekiel Abaddon, or whatever his name is. And you're like, but I know that this isn't a good guy, because in Warhammer 40k, he's the big bad.
Exactly. Oh,
this, Abaddon's this is the spoiler. Horus, and yeah, everyone knows what happens to Horus at the end of the Horus Heresy, and all these other characters, well, they're not around in Warhammer 40k, so none of them can matter. And there's just so much of that. Like, some of the story arcs are good, but it's all backstory, and it's really, really weird that they've spun it out for this long, I think.
Okay, I guess the caveat or the counter-argument to that potentially is, does the series of books provide a better grounding for a lot of the Primarchs and their legions, assuming that they will be released, right? Because we know that, for example, I mean, Sanguinius, dead.
Dead.
You know, and
I've got complaints about Sanguinius, but we can come back to those.
I'm sure you do. We can come back to that. Horus, but dead. Yes. But for example, Vulcan, you know, people love the Salamanders. You know, maybe by having the Horus Heresy book sort of, you know, contextualizes what happens to Vulcan, and that is good, not only for people who are fans, but also for, you know, model sales.
I think that's right. And it has spun off into its whole own game, right? There is a Horus Heresy tabletop war game.
Yeah, but that really baffles me, I must say.
It's just an excuse for Forge World specifically to sell some minis.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. It is a bit strange. But yeah, I mean, it gives context and colour to the legions. You spend a lot of time with the Dark Angels, the Space Wolves, the Salamanders, the Emperor's Children, all of these players in Warhammer 40k. And you're absolutely right. You see their Primarchs, and that, because we love tentpole heroes and villains, they're the building blocks around which the story revolves, and that all makes sense.
Yeah.
And they've all got quite good characterizations one way or another. But
yeah.
I don't know, I just...
And that I really enjoyed that. So for clarity, I think I got maybe 15 books in or so, and like I really binged them. But then you've witnessed the fall of Horus, of Fulgrim, of Angron, of all these guys, and you're like, well, now what? Now it's just more and more books that talk about meat too often.
Wet Leopard Growl. What was it? Wet Leopard Growls. And the smack thump sound of blades hitting meat or something like that.
It's just lots of uses of the word meat. It's like, I get it. It's visceral, it's 30k, but like, come on.
it's visceral, it's dehumanizing. I see what you're trying to do there, author. Yeah.
And I think this is maybe partly the issue, right? So we shouted out Dad Nebner in our wonderful intro.
We did. I want to sort of come back to Dan Abnett as well, because he's done something quite impressive and we should give him credit for that, but he's also written The End and the Death, and I think someone needs to be held accountable for that mess of a book.
Well, three books, isn't it?
Well, that was going to be part of my point, yes.
But by and large, the books that he has written in the Horus Heresy series and elsewhere are very good. Whereas some Black Library authors, shall we say, are just not for me.
And that is always going to be the problem of a book series that has something like 12 or 15 authors contributing to it at different times. You have different ways of telling stories.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be a challenge. So I think, you know, I come back to, I think the fact that they got to the end is an incredible achievement.
But I guess it is, given that they set out to make it this long.
But they didn't. This is, I think, something that we should talk about. So when they wrote Horus Rising, I think they were only planning maybe $5 to $7 to do the whole thing. Maybe ten at a push to get all the way to the Golden Throne and the fight on the Bridge of the Vengeful Spirit. Like, the whole thing was meant to be so much shorter. But then it turns out people just really like reading about Space Marines. Like, really like reading about Space Marines.
You know what the issue potentially is?
I dread to think.
There's some chronology issues for me, I think.
Right.
Right, because if you approach it from a sort of, you know, I like the Dark Angels, therefore I like the Dark Angels books point of view, for example.
Yes.
You know, then you might read the books about the Lion. But you might care about his origin story, which is in the Horus Heresy series mm-hmm. of books. But it have fundamentally nothing to do with the Horus Heresy, right? It's literally just about Lionel Johnson and how he was found. So why did we have to sort of conflate those in order to tell that story? Why can't it just be a separate thing?
Because Primarch... No, I can't speak. Because Primarchs sell. That's the answer. Like,
fundamentally, I know, I get that, answer. But why make it Horus Heresy and not just, you know, here's your Dark Angel series of books, here's your Blood Angel series of books, here's your Salamanders, here's your Emperor's
Children. Because a lot of them are interconnected. Like, a lot of those books have Emperor's Children and Iron Hands and Word Bearers and World Eaters and Death Guard, and they're all interacting with each other. There are a few self-contained books. So Fear to Tread, for example, is a self-contained Blood Angels book, which has a few other characters in it, but really doesn't. Whatever the first Dark Angels book is, Descent of Angels. Like, that's a self-contained Lionel Johnson origin story. It just is.
Yeah, but that's my point. But it's a Horus Heresy book for some reason.
It sort of isn't. It sort of isn't, because these things all play off each other. But some of them are more self-contained than others. And I think that the problem of the Horus Heresy as a series of 62 books is it didn't know when to be self-contained, and it didn't know when to be interconnected. And it didn't know when to cut off some of the self-contained elements that actually people just didn't want to read. I can't remember what the book is. I think it's Damnation of Pythos, which is just bad. Like, there's no two ways about it. It's just a bad book. It's badly written. It has a poor plot. It's not got any compelling characters. I think it exists to show that, like, the effects of chaos are being felt more widely across the Imperium than just on the front lines. Blah, 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 blah. But everyone in the book dies at the end, and it doesn't matter. Nothing in that book happens that affects the rest of the Horus Heresy at all.
See, and that's really interesting, right? Because I think that's a problem. But equally, I think the problem is if you're reading a book about, you know, say Lionel Johnson, you know what's going to happen, right? There's zero stakes in any of the books in the Horus Heresy because you know exactly how everything ends. It'll give you flavor, perhaps, but you know, right? You know that you're not going to be able to collect a Horus army in 40K because he's gone.
Yeah.
You know that you're not going to be able to put Sanguinius in your Blood Angels army. So the stakes just zero. This is the whole problem I have with the series to an extent.
That was going to be something that I, you know, came onto. So you take Fear to Tread. Again, I'm a Blood Angels fan, so it's one that I've read more frequently than some other ones, but also it's one that stuck in my head more. And there's a section in that where Sanguinius is, like, in a coma because he's had a fight with a Bloodthirster, and the Bloodthirster kills 500 Blood Angels in a single axe swing because scale apparently doesn't matter when you're writing a Black Library book.
It just doesn't. No.
And all the, you know, doctors and psychers and everyone are like, oh my god, what do we do? The angel can't die, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, yeah, he's not going to die. Because
he dies later.
he dies on the bridge of the vengeful spirit. Like, I know he's going to get better and, you know, get up off that chair and go and bitch slap that bloodthirster.
See, I know, okay.
The end.
But that is an example, right, where they could have been creative and they could have set up Sanguinius's death because of something that happens in this book.
Yes, they could have.
Right, the bloodthirster has a magical sword that nicked him in just the wrong place, and that's ultimately what made Horus, you know, ruin his back.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
Could have done.
But I always got the sense from reading Horus Heresy books that they... I don't really want to have a go at the authors because I think it's probably more a publisher issue, but they sort of never got the creative license to say, have fun with it.
I think that's I think they had creative license to have fun with the books, if you like. So you can tell that some of there's almost glee when some of the authors are writing some of the sections and some of the ludicrousness and all of that. But I do think there was a lot of stuff that they just weren't allowed to touch.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, everyone knows that Sanguinius dies at the end, but, you know, how we get there, why don't you guys figure it out?
Yeah, and there was a whole bunch of theory posting in the run-up to The End and the Death, and in particular The End and the Death Volume 2, which ends with the death of Sanguinius. But, like, this was all, you know, what if actually Sanguinius kills Horus and then the Emperor has to kill Sanguinius, or what if the Emperor turns and Sanguinius and Horus work together to kill him, or all of this stuff. And at the end, it's, no, just happens exactly the way we've been told. It happens right the way since, like, the very start of Warhammer 40k.
Yeah.
Almost beat for beat.
Because they could have... I mean, I get it, right? They obviously need to stick to their canon. But they could have, again, been creative and said, you know, why don't we make this a sort of unreliable narrator type thing? Where, as you say,
show the fight from three different angles, yeah, and see three different things.
Exactly. So at the end, it's some random guard who's on the ship, and he looks at the Emperor and thinks he's turned. And as you say, then Sanguinius and Horus somehow fight together. You know, you could have done all sorts of things with it.
But they didn't.
And this was, to me, in addition to when you're binging literally 15 books in a row, it's, you know, the writing is kind of samey.
Yeah, that's just a problem with it. It is just pulpy sci-fi at the end of the day.
So it was a bit of an overload, but then equally it's sort of like, you know, I just... You can tell that there's not going to be anything groundbreaking here, which is a bit of a shame, because a lot of them are very good. Like, there's some really phenomenal authors, I think, who contribute to the... contribute to the Black Library in general. But,
It did some phenomenal things. So the White Scars, for example, were always a sort of bit part army, right? They weren't one of the big four Space Marine forces. They were always sidelined. They didn't really have any kind of cohesive culture they're sort of a little bit maybe Asian, but not really, because we don't want them to be racist caricatures, so they're sort of not really anything. And then they have a three-book arc in the Horus Heresy and the Siege of Terror that absolutely turns them into a fan favorite, and the Khan is amongst most people's favorite Primarchs because of how well they're written.
Yeah.
That's all down to James Swallow's writing. James Swallow? Chris Raitt, not James Swallow. James Swallow writes Blood Angels. Chris Raitt's writing. That's all.
And that's another thing they could have. Himself. Yeah, sorry. That's another thing they could have really gone for, right? It said, you know, we all know what the Lunar Wolves get up to. We all know what the Blood Angels get up to. We all know what the Imperial Fist get up to.
Yeah.
We don't know what the fuck are the Raven Guard? Is that the name? Yeah.
They're such a non-entity.
But that's the thing. Like, what are they doing? You know, what's the Alpha Legion doing? I guess no one knows. But these legions that probably sell less well. I mean, they don't even have separate sort of codices, right? So big them up. Make something out of them.
What drives what? Do the Blood Angels sell well because they have a good narrative, or do they have a good narrative because they sell well? I don't really know. It's probably a bit of both, but...
But they could have played with it, right?
They could have done, and they did. They did, to an extent. They gave us these legion characteristics for the less popular legions. A bit. Like, yeah. I say, with the White Scars, they do some of a bit with the Iron Hands, but the Iron Hands problem is we don't spend any time with them because Ferris Manus dies in book three of a 62-book series.
It's a shame because I think the Legion's probably quite cool, but yeah.
But they don't have time because when they wrote The Death of Ferris Manus, they thought they were writing 10 books.
Yeah, that's something actually you can kind of tell in the earlier books, right? They were really trying to get to an end, and then it was like, oh, we have ages. Oh,
these are selling like mad.
Because you sort of get to Istvan 5 or 6 or 7, I never remember the number, but you get there really quickly, and then everything just fucking grinds to a halt.
the pacing, we talk about pacing so often on this podcast, but the pacing is so bizarre because of exactly that. You absolutely race to the Istvan system in 3 books, and then it takes Horus 51 books to get to Terra. What?
Yeah, I know, right? And then comparatively, there's only 8 books of the siege, right? So you think that's a slightly bigger event.
Fine. In a way, because
I really hope that 7 of them are just Dorne going, we need bigger walls.
To be fair, someone who I think has come out of the siege really, really well is Rogel Dorne. His character is very well put together through the siege.
He's already like one of the most beloved Primarchs out there.
It's true. He is popular. Angry Dorne is great. But no, so the siege is good because each of the books deals more or less with a different facet of the siege. So you've got the Solar War, which is the like the opening salvos, the sort of traitor fleet descending on Terra through the solar system, and that's pretty good. And then you've got the Lost and the Damned, which is about the first fighting on Terra itself, and that's full of quite a lot of hope, but you start to see the breakdown of the of real space. And then you've got
what actually happens on Mars.
Mars is they just bypass it because Mars is embroiled in civil war for the entire they just bypass it.
Convenient.
They just don't bother. There's like in this Mechanicum in the Horus Heresy, which is like I think the only bit that really focuses on Mars, and it's just turns out Mars is really important. We probably should have paid more attention to bye. But yeah, so then you've got like they're not space marines, they don't sell. You've got a Titan fight, you've got like a Spec Ops book, which is really fun. You've got
but where's my Siege of Terror book where it just cuts the line cruising through space doing nothing? That's the book I want to read.
There's Gilliman is in the last few. It's just like, I gotta get there soon, tell them to light the beacons, I gotta get there soon. It's just like, he's not gonna get there in time. It's really funny, but I have some complaints with the end and the death. I want to pivot to talking about other series that have finished and how it's become so difficult to finish these great, massive series that we've come to enjoy.
Before we get on to that, are there any good books that revolve around the Emperor, you think?
Master of Mankind.
It's not a good book.
You don't like it?
It's way too confused.
Fair enough. I think all books that feature the Emperor are confused at when it comes to the Emperor by design.
I think that's it, because there's a lot of good about that book, but the Emperor-focused... actually, the history's quite interesting. But the quote-unquote modern-day Emperor is really confusing, I think. Although it's arguably more that demon.
I think it's the demon of the first murder that's the problem in that book, The End of Empires.
It might actually be.
I think that demon is the problem in that book. It might actually be. And I don't sort of understand why it's not. Like, I do fundamentally understand why it's not Belacor or someone like that, but it should be. It should be Belacor or Samus or someone like that who's conceptually easier to understand than.
Yeah, but I think, but I guess it's the problem, and this is sort of what I'm trying to get at, maybe, is that if you make the antagonist of the Emperor Belacor, Belacor just dies.
Well, that is the problem.
Whereas, so you need a demon that's like super quirky, but then
you need
it's
a demon
just an
that's
unintelligible
his exact
book.
Opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it just makes the whole book be way too weird.
But so I don't know who wrote Master of Mankind. I think it is the best emperor focused book. Well, sort of the only emperor focused book. He's not even really the focus of End and the Death, although he's in it a lot more than he's in a lot of the other books. But the setting breaks if you give us an emperor point of view. It just breaks. I think
that's
true. A problem that the authors recognized at the start.
It'd be like writing from Korn's perspective, right? Doesn't really work.
And I'm fairly sure the author of the of Master of Mankind, I think it's Aaron Dembski-Bowden.
Yeah, I think so.
I think he basically came out and said, "Yeah, you're not meant to know the answers after reading Master of Mankind, but you're meant to have more of an idea of the right sort of questions that you should be asking about the Emperor," if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. But the issue I have then with the rest of the book is that it's too sprawling as well. So that message gets a bit lost.
Yeah.
Because there's like the whole Admech bit, then there's the whole Custodes bit, then there's the whole Blood Angels bit.
Yeah.
And the whole Random House bit. It's like there's way too much going on if you're trying to sort of tell me that the whole point of the book is that I'm not capable of understanding the Emperor like this.
But they need to give you all of those perspectives so that you can get all of those perspectives on the Emperor, so you can see how everyone not only interacts with the Emperor differently, but sees the Emperor differently.
Yeah, I think maybe, but I think they just missed the mark on actually delivering that.
You're not wrong. I, to be completely clear, I don't disagree with you. I think I can completely see what the author was trying to do. I don't know that they've nailed it, but I think that's a little bit because they were almost trying to write, like, Ulysses or...
Yeah.
Something like that. That's a bad example, but, you know, a book where you get to the end and you go, wait, whose perspective was I even following the whole time?
Which is actually ironic because I guess that is what I was advocating for before, right? That they should have fun with this and explore sort of interesting concepts.
I think
here they do
it,
and I don't know if it works, but, you know.
I think that's the problem a lot, because I say this about the Black Library quite a lot, but it is just pulp. Like, at the end of the day, it's not high literature. It's not meant to really be introspective or make us really sit back and think about the human condition or any of that. Like, it can do that as a byproduct, but this is literature that exists to sell plastic miniatures of dudes with guns.
I think that is something you just cannot get away from. Yeah,
and that's not not something you can get away from.
And it's also not really criticism at the end of the day, right? I mean, this
because it does what it sets out to do really, really well.
Yeah.
I think is the problem.
I mean, yeah. Well, I was going to say it has coincided with a lot of new 40k models, but I don't know if that's because of Horus Heresy. Probably not, really. As you say, it's probably the 30k models that.
Well, I think it probably drives some people into the hobby because they pick up Horus Rising and Waterstones. And go, ooh, this is interesting. I've vaguely heard about Games Workshop. Let's have
see
a
that,
read. Ooh, these guys are cool.
Yeah, that. I'd love to see the numbers on that. Like, how many people read Horus Heresy books who didn't?
I have no idea how you even work that out. Not many, but some is going to be.
But it
guess.
Could be loads, as you say, right? As in, more people visit Waterstones than a Games Workshop, I would imagine.
Many of them gravitate to the fantasy bit of the Waterstones?
Yeah, no, that's entirely fair, but it's sort of, it would be nice to think that this brought more people into the hobby.
I think it has done. I think in absolute terms, it will have brought people into the hobby. I don't think there's any denying that. I just don't know how many.
Yeah. I guess it's also partly sort of to bring over the crowd from Warhammer Fantasy, for example, or people are playing the Lord of the Rings game or whatever. It's like, oh, yeah, here's a massive book series you can read that gets you sort of up to speed with these other models that we have, you know?
That's also very true, yeah.
But yeah, no, I get it. So anyway, I massively derailed you from making a very poignant point, I'm sure, about ending series.
I'm not sure how poignant it is. I think you're setting me up for failure there. But
I mean, you do that yourself usually.
I do.
I thought I'd take that for you today.
Enjoy hoisting myself.
The real problem
with the end and the death is it's the culmination of a 62 book series. Like, there is no way, or not no way, but it would be so difficult for those three books to deliver an adequate resolution, a satisfying resolution to a conflict for which we already knew the resolution. Does that make sense? It's sort of the same objection that we had right at the start when we were talking. Everyone knows how the story ends.
Well, I think that specifically, I guess you're referring, well, are you referring to the end of the Horus Heresy or specifically the fight between Horus and the Emperor?
It's one and the same, the way it's written in the book.
Okay, but no, but this is going to be a point, right? Because I think, for me, there is a level of excitement for sort of knowing what actually went down on Horus's flagship between Horus, Sanguinius, and the Emperor. Like, what actually happened? Why is Sanguinius dead? Why is the Emperor as good as dead? And so on and so forth. These are quite big questions that we don't really have good answers for.
Do you want me to just tell you the answers? Because they're not particularly satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, spoiler warning for anybody who is reading the books and doesn't know that the Emperor nearly dies.
Spoiling basically all of the end and the death. So, the Emperor Sanguinius, Dorne, Valdor, and essentially a strike team of two groups of custodes, a group of Blood Angels and a group of Imperial Fists, teleport onto the Vengeful Spirit.
That's just not enough lads.
Sorry?
That's just not enough lads.
It's not that many lads. To be fair, most of the Sons of Horus are on Terra. But, like, it all goes awry because it turns out it's a trap from Horus. And there's a bit of, does the Emperor know it's a trap or does he not know it's a trap? But actually, this isn't about the fight between Horus and the Emperor. It's about the crowning of the fifth Chaos God, the Dark King, who is almost certainly the Emperor. But at the last minute, the Emperor throws off the mantle of the Dark King because one of his old mates turns up and basically says, don't be a dick. And
love that.
Do you remember Al Pearson and John Grammaticus, the Perpetuals?
I know of them, but I don't really know why I know of them, because I don't think I've ever read a book with them in it.
People complain about them in the fandom a lot.
It turns out that narrows it down, ultimately.
Al Pearson was the first ever War Master for the Emperor, when the Emperor threw down the Tower of Babel in Neolithic times. And he's been his mate sort of ever since. And then he walked away at some point because he thought the Emperor was trying to go too far and too fast. Anyway, the Emperor gets talked down from becoming the Dark King. But as these strike teams teleport onto the Ventral Spirit, they get separated because Horus commands time and space, because he's the incarnate vessel of the four Chaos Gods, blah, 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 blah.
Naturally.
As you are, Sanguinius makes his way to Horus's throne room first, sort of greets Horus, fights Horus there. And it's really weird because you get the problem, one of the problems that I have with the end and the death is probably my biggest problem, is I think it's actually badly written from like actual word choice perspective. It's written like Dan Abnett. I think I've said this to you before. It's written like Dan Abnett decided to try and prove that he knew lots of words. So the
because this is also where he changes tenses a lot in this book, doesn't he? Or
he changes parisons. So he writes. He writes. Most of the book is written in slightly confusing third person limited, which is sort of standard novel.
Mm-hmm.
Malkador is written in the first person.
I mean, he is the big cheese, so yeah, it makes sense.
Some people are written in a sort of third person limited with subtext, which is weird. And then Horace is written in the second person.
Yeah, which sort of just breaks my brain.
It's so bizarre. It takes ages to work out that's what it's doing. And it's trying, I think, to show you that Horace is in some sort of dissociative state where he's not really in control, but he thinks he's in control, and it's not clear if the voice that's narrating as Horace is Horace, or if it's the Chaos Gods, like which bit of Horace is describing the actions of the other bit. So that's really difficult to read. So you get the fight from Sanguinius's perspective, and he's absolutely dicking on Horace.
Naturally.
And then you get the fight from Horace's perspective, and it looks like Sanguinius is absolutely dicking on Horace as well, but Horace doesn't seem to... He's, like, getting angry about that fact. He's not scared. And then something changes, and I can't remember exactly what. And then all of a sudden, like, Horace just decides that he's going to start winning. And then it becomes all about the fact that Horace has mastery of the... like time and space, so he's able to move his hands through dimensions that don't exist or along angles that don't exist, or it becomes really weird. And
I don't necessarily hate that, but that's difficult to write.
It's so hard to write, and I think the Sanguinius fight sort of is written quite well from that perspective, because I still don't know if Sanguinius was actually winning, or if the whole thing was a trap, and Horace was just playing with him. And he had to, like, call on more power of the Chaos Gods to defeat him, which I think is, like, one possible interpretation. But anyway, Sanguinius gets the shit absolutely kicked out of him, and as a Blood Angels fan, it's really funny. Like, it's really funny. It's like the scene from Avengers where the Hulk, like, smashes Loki on the floor.
Why is that funny from, like, a Blood Angels fan perspective?
Like, because it's just so cartoonishly evil, because Sanguinius is this, like, great, pure, angelic figure. And the whole way through the Horus Heresy, he's just been this massive paragon of hope and virtue for the Defenders. And then, at the end, he just absolutely gets shat on by Horus. And, like, I don't know, I just find it really funny, even as a Blood Angels player.
I say, as a Dark Angels fan, that does sound really funny, because it's like, yeah, no, it's always this uppity fucking larger than life, holier than thou twit with wings.
to be fair, even in the fight, Horus acknowledges that no one else would it be able to come that close to him. So Sanguinius is still the best.
Oh, such bullshit. Such fucking weird plot armor. Stop giving the guy plot armor. He's one of two fucking Primarchs to die, okay? He's in Ferus Manus' illustrious company.
To be fair, that's...
He doesn't even have a head.
True. That is true.
Anyway, moving on.
Then the Emperor turns up and he's a bit like, "You've killed my son." And there's, like, they have a really...
And does he actually say son?
Yeah, but he does say son, but he's talking to the Chaos Gods, not to Horus. So he's not talking about Sanguinius. He's talking
about Horus.
To the Chaos. Yeah, it's so weird. And then Horus and the Emperor fight.
And so wait. So when does the Dark Mantle thing happen then?
What, the Dark King?
Yeah. So yeah.
Emperor's thrown this off by then. The Dark King has ended.
That happens when he teleports onto the Vengeful Spirit.
Yeah. So it's part of the trap.
Right. Okay.
Part of the trap is to get the Emperor to. But also, the Vengeful Spirit is.
Probably just some conduit into the warp, isn't it?
Terror, the Vengeful Spirit, and the warp all become the same place by the end of the siege. So there's people who like get onto the Vengeful Spirit by walking through a door on Terra, for example. But actually, the Vengeful Spirit is also just a conduit to the warp itself. So, you know, the Emperor has to march leagues and leagues and leagues and leagues to get to the throne room, while Sanguinius is in the Vengeful Spirit itself and only walks down a corridor type thing.
Right, okay. So, yeah, fine.
Dawn
so
gets trapped in a desert for centuries.
Classic. Classic Dawn.
Oh, it's really good. Dawn gets trapped in a desert and is being tempted by Khorne, basically. Trying to get Khorne over the course of centuries. Trying to get Dawn over the course of centuries to say blood for the blood god and so become a sort of Khorne Primarch. It's really, really fun. Because he keeps thinking he's going to slip. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no. Dawn can never fall.
But he starts to slip and starts to slip and starts to slip. And so he pulls himself back by giving Khorne a lecture on the morals of war.
But that's exactly what I mean.
Through history.
That's just so Rogel Dawn. That's why he can't fall, because every time he slips, he's like, hang on a minute, you don't make any fucking sense.
But his last act, sort of getting out of his desert prison, is to put his mouth to a crack in the wall through which Khorne has been whispering to him and go, there are no gods, not even you. And then he just walks away, and it's just like, oh my god, that's such a good flex.
That's such a good line. Go on, Dawn.
It's so good. I really like Rogel Dawn. It's a shame the Imperial Fists are yellow, because I really like them.
Well, this is why Black Templars are a thing, you know.
This is why Black Templars are a thing. So you can be an Imperial Fists fan, but not have to paint yellow. The Emperor and Horus fight, and they go back and forth, and like you only really get the fight from Horus's perspective. This is the problem, and you only get it in that second person perspective.
No, but see, that's the thing then. So is the Emperor fighting Horus, or is he fighting the puppeteers, quote unquote?
He's fighting Horus, but Horus is drawing on so much power of the Chaos Gods that it's like they're taking over. So Horus keeps getting struck down and keeps drawing in more power into himself.
But I guess this is what I'm sort of like, is the Emperor trying to kill Horus, or is the Emperor trying to save Horus?
So in the end, he's trying to kill Horus.
In the end, sure.
I don't know what he's trying to do at the start. They're just fighting. I think he's trying to kill Horus the whole way through, but the idea is that the Chaos Gods have vested so much of their power in Horus that killing Horus weakens them. I think. But...
Right.
It's so weird.
Because ultimately the Emperor, like, just unleashes his full potential, right? So you wonder why not do that from the beginning.
He has... Okay, this is a thing that I'm really annoyed about. He has to get the Chaos Gods to withdraw enough of their power from Horus, or get Horus to put up enough of the power that Horus can't draw on the power of the Chaos Gods to rejuvenate himself. If that makes sense.
No. What?
So the Emperor keeps striking Horus down. And Horus essentially keeps getting back up because the Chaos Gods have poured so much of their power into him that he's essentially capable of coming back from anything.
Right.
So what the Emperor ends up needing to do is essentially trick Horus into proving that he's not at the mercy of the Chaos Gods. That he's in control. And he proves that he's in control by like throwing as much of the power out as, or throwing enough of the power out that the Emperor can then stab him with a MacGuffin and use the MacGuffin as a conduit to pour all of his psychic power into him.
I said there's a MacGuffin. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, it comes out of nowhere halfway through the book.
He's like, oh, here's the Spear of Destiny, guys. Hey!
I think it's meant to be... the knife that was used by Cain to kill Abel or something. Like, it's not explicitly said.
That is, I mean...
Also, didn't Cain kill Abel with a rock?
It's a niche reference, especially in the year like 30-something thousand, from a guy who's not religious. But then he might have well been Cain.
But it's not true. It's not specific. It's like the dagger that was used in the first murder. It's not necessarily Cain and Abel.
Okay, fine.
That sort of thing.
Doesn't that bring it back to that demon then? Yeah. Let's not go there again. That demon just scares me. just scares my brain.
I don't know if it's that. It's a dagger imbued with sort of singular significance, basically. Yeah. And that becomes the conduit. So Horus has put up enough of the power. He can't take it back in fast enough. So the Emperor is then able to use that dagger as a conduit to basically burn Horus out from the inside. But this is the thing that really annoys me. The lore has always been that Sanguinius struck the blow that damaged Horus's armor such that the Emperor was able to exploit that weakness to kill Horus. Nope.
Of course not.
Sanguinius does strike a massive blow that wounds Horus and damages his armor. But this random piece of rock that the Emperor uses as a dagger is sharp enough to go through the best armor ever made by Mars.
Yeah, of course.
Like, and it just goes through the armor like it was paper. Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Fuck you, Sanguinius. You achieved nothing in your life.
It's so frustrating because it could have gone in the hole that Sanguinius made in the armor.
Nope. That takes away from the Emperor. but how does Horus then?
Oh no, the Emperor's like had the shit kicked out of him for ages.
But he keeps beating that Horus.
He's not able to regenerate as quickly as Horus because he doesn't have access to the same wellspring of power that Horus has.
Yeah, sure, but then, but why not after the fact?
Because he's not capable of it. The only thing holding him together is the willpower to strike the killing blow, basically.
I see.
He's unconscious, he's in a coma, he's dying.
Plus he's Obi-Wan Kenobi, he wants to become one with the Force.
Also that, yeah.
Okay, I mean,
it's fine.
Yeah,
as a resolution to a pulpy sci-fi series, it's fine.
Like it sounds like they tried to do a little bit.
They tried to do a little bit, and all Pearson is there, and he gets sliced into 27 million pieces by Horus, which is quite good. And Loken is there and watches the fall and has a denouement with Abaddon after, which is quite good. You see Abaddon's decision to take over.
Fucking hell, really?
Yeah, he's there at the end. He's there at the start. He's there at the end.
Yeah.
You get a massive fuck you Erebus moment, which is always nice.
That's always good. You said Valdor was there. Surely he's doing something.
He's probably the King in Yellow from Dan Abnett's other stuff. Because he has a spear that grants him the knowledge of whatever he stabs. So he's like,
that comes out of nowhere.
Oh, he's had that for ages.
Yeah, no, but as in, so what is he doing in the final fight? Is he
fighting with Doran to get to the Emperor?
Oh, I see. Okay,
but he's sent off into the middle of nowhere, so it's hard for him to get there. So he arrives after the Emperor has, and after Horus is dead and the Emperor has fallen, basically. He's too late.
Is there any interaction from the Emperor at all after the big fight?
No, he does a thing. They have a fight through Taro. Part of their fight is through the Imperial Taro. So he manifests Taro. I swear it's like a fucking game of Yu-Gi-Oh! At one point. It's like, I hear you not. It's like he plays the throne, so I play the demon inverted across it, but then he reverses the juggernaut.
Love it. I'll
piss off.
Fuck, that's great.
It's really, really fun. It is written like it's a Magic the Gathering or a Yu-Gi-Oh!
That's amazing.
But the Emperor is found lying next to the throne, which is a card from the Imperial Tarot deck. And everyone's like, it's his only way of communicating. I don't know.
Okay.
It all sort of works. It does all stand together. It's not incoherent. It's just, I don't know, it's both too long and rushed, if that's possible.
Yeah. I think we've said that about stuff before. Can't remember exactly what. But I think that's true of a lot of Black Library stuff, right? Like, it's, you know, as you said before, the pacing is arguably the biggest problem with a lot of it. But yeah, I mean, it's over. Horus is dead. Sanguinius is dead. The Emperor is dead-ish.
Basically dead.
So what is next for the Black Library, which is ostensibly what we've named this episode? Where does the Black Library go from here? What are we selling?
Where does the Black... The obvious answer is do the Scouring.
I was going to say, remastered the Horus Heresy?
Remastered the Horus Heresy. Yeah. Tell the story again. I think you do the Scouring in a 3 or 5 book series. So you do Doran and Gillum. You clear the other Primarchs off the table. So you do Doran at the Iron Cage. You do...
So you're Gillum. Staying in 30K.
It feels unresolved in some ways. Because you still don't know how you get from...
You can't be unresolved after 62 fucking books.
But you don't know how you get from there to here still after 62 fucking books. You just don't. Gilliman's arrived at Terra.
Yeah, but does it matter?
The traitors are in retreat.
Because that's 10... Because how long... What time frame are we talking about in the Horus Heresy?
30K?
Yeah.
M30, sorry.
Yeah, but we're talking like a couple of years or a couple of decades, right?
The Horus Heresy takes 7 years.
Yeah, there you go, seven years. 62 books for 7 years. Can you imagine how many books we're going to need to cover 10,000?
Lots doesn't happen. But my point is there are still Primarchs. There are still Primarchs kicking around until they're cleared off the board. At least most of them. Like, don't you need to do that? Maybe you don't.
I think you
Maybe
do. You I think you do want to write those books, as in what happens to Gilliman and why is it really funny? What happens to Dorne? What happens to the Khan? What happens to all these guys? You know, what happens in the aftermath of the Heresy? But that's the sort of each Primarch gets their book, probably, right? And then... What happens after that, yeah? How do you establish the church of the Emperor? Like, how do people go so wrong so quickly?
That's the thing. We've seen its beginning in the Siege. We've seen the beginning of the Inquisition in the Siege. We've seen lots of beginnings, but they're so embryonic as to not be recognisable if you don't know that's what they are.
Mm. Yeah, that the Inquisition, sense? That's very interesting, actually. And the Dorne
founds the Inquisition, which you wouldn't expect. But it's an act of Rogel Dorne that gives the first group of people the authority to go out and form the Inquisition.
That kind of does feel very Dornish.
They're too shadowy for Dorne.
Well, but are they? Because they're usually very, very open about it, right? But maybe not by Ben, I suppose. But the Inquisitors that I sort of know are like, they're always on a secret mission, but within 5 seconds they're like, I'm an Inquisitor!
I'm an Inquisitor, give me your best ship!
Yeah, it's like, good stealth, guys. Good stuff.
That's true. You're right. You're right. I don't know, there's stuff like that. How do you get from... I don't know. Is it even a vague sense of hope?
Maybe. Well, it's not. Maybe that's the big unanswered question, right? And I'm not sure where I'm going to get it because ultimately, again, trying to sell models over here and not resolve.
Yeah.
The war and create peace. But it's a sort of like what? Can we get a glimpse of? You know, the Emperor's grand plan, perhaps, if we are to assume that he is still working on it.
All we get told over and over again is this is the death of that future. But we don't know what that future actually really is, other than what we get in Master of Mankind. And that's so fucking unclear.
Yeah. And this is always the slight issue, right? Is that the Emperor clearly, I mean, he had a major fascination with the warp. And we assume that is because he's trying to get rid of it. Well, all the Chaos Gods at least, but that's probably one of the same thing in a way.
Yeah.
And so now that he kind of is nothing but a warpish being, is that, you know, is that what he wanted? Is that what he's trying to do? Is it all just going to stop existing at one point?
Is it just stagnation? No, is all he's trying to do preserve the status quo because that's all he can do?
Well, that, yeah. And that is why you get, Universe of Eternal War. But why? Like, does he care about the status quo? That's always the thing that's been unclear to me.
The only thing he's ever shown to care about is humanity as a concept. He doesn't care about people. He cares about humanity. So any action that he can take for the preservation of the concept of humanity, he will see as a good.
But this is kind of interesting and problematic in a way, right? Because we can argue about that concept. And you would think that, you know...
Well, I think he means it from almost a physiological perspective. He's talking about the species.
Possibly, right? But that's important, I think. Because he might well sort of say, oh, philosophically, actually, the Tau are much more what I was thinking of. But, and now they exist, so I'm going to...
But they're not human.
Yeah, no, but that's it, right? Does he actually care about, as you say, the human and the physiology that entails? And,
I think and everything he does. Specific to that? I think.
But it's so eroded, right? Like over time.
From everything that I've read, I think that what the Emperor cares about is literally, at a very simplistic level, the human genome.
But then why has he changed it so much?
But they're not human.
No, but that's like his crowning achievement, right? Is to improve on the human physiology.
No. I don't think that's right. Primarchs aren't the goal. Primarchs are a tool.
Sure. But like,
same with Space Marine, same with Custodes.
Yeah, but the point is that he's actually gone in and made improvements, right? You don't really improve on something that you hold to be perfect.
No, he doesn't hold it to be... I don't think he holds it to be perfect, but he holds it to be the thing that he has decided he's going to work for, if that makes sense. I don't think he thinks that humanity is perfect. Maybe he does. But what he cares about is... This is going to sound really stupid. You and I, just... Not you and I, but the idea of a group of sapient individuals of the human gene stock is what he cares about.
He's That's effectively it. Just nostalgic, isn't he? He's just a big fan Maybe. Of Earth.
Maybe.
You know, it's where I'm from, it's where I'll always be from, and this is why I believe in
He's actually just massively xenophobic. But he's also shown to not actually be xenophobic. Like, he, personally, I don't think is xenophobic. He just recognises that they're not human, so they're in the way of... I don't think he cares enough to be xenophobic.
He's like the ultimate sort of, as you say, the individual is completely irrelevant, but the collective is everything.
Didn't you once suggest that he was the ultimate tyrannid?
Yeah, did I? That does sound like something I would say. But sure it kind of makes sense, yeah.
I'm sure that's where humanid came from.
Oh, yeah, humanid. Yeah.
He doesn't want collective consciousness.
No.
But he would happily sacrifice 1 million people to save 1,000,001 people.
Yeah, because that's just logical.
He's the ultimate pragmatist.
Yeah.
Where your pragmatic goal is the preservation and furtherance of the human race.
Am I going to be a fan of the Emperor? Oh no. It's happening.
Oh no.
I might be a fan of the Emperor. Oh no. This is how it starts. This is how I become the Emperor of mankind. I don't hate the sound of that, actually.
Let's hit you in the face with a railway sleeper and see if you get better.
Oh, well, we just learned that even the Emperor can't take, you know, a mild beating. So, that doesn't prove anything.
I think because they're in the warp, I think they're meant to fight for centuries. It's so weird. They're like, They fight through philosophical concepts at one point.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Is this a morality versus mathematics debate?
I think it genuinely might be. I think at one point the Emperor counters, like, using Euclid's third axiom or something stupid like that.
And Horace is just like, oh, not the third axiom! No! Well, you know, as we said, the Black Library is nothing if not entertaining for sometimes all the wrong reasons.
Any time you see a paragraph filled with capital letters in a Black Library book, you start to shake with fear. Yeah. What are they doing to the English language?
This could be the greatest passage you've ever read, or it could be complete garbage.
There's a really, really funny passage that gets quoted, and there's no way I can read it, because I don't have it in front of me, and also we don't have 20 minutes. But it's from the first volume of The End and the Death. It's about a page and a half long. It's a single sentence from Malkador's perspective as he's like flying through the palace with his mind's eye. And I swear it was just someone bet Dan Abnett that he couldn't do that. I bet you can't do a one sentence over more than one page of nothing but description. And he's like, I absolutely fucking can, mate.
That's great. I rate that.
Look it up. I'll see if I can find it. I'll see if I can find it. I'll share it in the Discord. It's so stupid.
If we could get Dan Abnett on the show, that'd be absolutely amazing. So if for some reason you're listening...
He's not doing anything else. No, he's finished his magnum opus.
But that's the thing, right? For like a genuinely great author to be working on this weird series that's so dictated by a third party.
I think he's one of the... Dictators is too strong a word. I think he's got a huge influence.
He's sort of in the know, if you will, I guess.
He's in the inner circle. I think there was a group of four or five of them who were sort of in the inner circle who got to set the pretty narrow strokes direction.
But still, it's sort of a, you know, we're all... There's a party whip here, you know, so that there's like...
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, for example, I do think a couple of times they were setting up, you know, maybe something different went down on the bridge. Maybe it's not as simple as Horace kills Sanguinius, the Emperor kills Horace. And I'm fairly sure it would have been a decision that was taken out of their hands. Now, maybe they would have made the same decision in any event, but that decision would have been made by Games Workshop, I reckon.
Yeah. The hive mind has shown up. Orcs spring out of the ground, you know. Who knows where they could have gone with it. You can tell I'm not a Black Library author, actually.
Not even that heady standard.
No.
We've got so many other things to talk about in the minus 10 minutes left to us.
Yeah, well, I liked your other series thing, but I think this might have to be sizzle now.
I think it just needs to be another episode. It
might have to be another mini-series, one might argue.
Ooh.
Sizzle.
We're going to have more mini-series than actual episodes, but yes, you're right. This ending other series is an absolute...
Yeah, well, I mean, so instead of like, where does Black Library go? It's sort of like, how do you end epic series? And why are we doing it better than anyone else?
Yeah.
Because endings are notoriously our strong suit.
Why won't the MCU end?
Why would this episode of Expertise is Overrated end? Because we just like to keep talking filibuster.
Now, well, just before we do finish, please give us feedback on our new outro.
Yes, because you're still listening. Let me know if you heard me say that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Expertise is Overrated. No doubt, we said some things that were either objectively wrong or downright offensive. As ever, feel free to let us know, rate the podcast wherever you can, check out our Patreon for bonus content, and come chat to us on Discord.
If you're lucky, we might just argue with you in one of our upcoming episodes, and if you're really lucky, we might call you an idiot. Come back next time for some more absolute nonsense.